So good morning, everyone. It is wonderful to see everyone in our last official class of 2023. The Gregorian year comes to an end. I hope that you had a wonderful Boxing Day. I grew up in Canada, so for me, Boxing Day was a big thing where I didn't understand. As a little boy, I said, Ima, why are we celebrating like Muhammad Ali or George Foreman? She said, no, David, she said, it means that people got lousy presents on the 25th of December, and then the tradition is to box them up and return them. I said, oh, okay. So that's a kind of a British thing. So if you're a part of the colonies, as we're known, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, then you probably celebrate Boxing Day. It was kind of like Black Friday. We had big Boxing Day sales, which is weird because they were always closed on Boxing Day, but they had sales. So I guess Boxing Day was December 27th. I don't know. Okay, let us begin with our class today, Israel's Hope. So it's going to have a thematic element, the hope, the idea of tikva. We know that Israel's national anthem is literally ha-tikva, the hope. So that's going to obviously connect us. And when we speak of Israel, we speak of Israel on three different levels. Interesting. We speak of Jacob, because he was our father Israel, the first person to get the moniker of Israel. We speak of the nation, the B'nai Israel, everyone in this room and all 14 million of us in the world. We are the children of Israel, the B'nai Israel. And then thirdly, we think of Israel, the country, the modern iteration of Israel, if you will. So there's three different levels to Israel that we'll weave in our little discussion and learning today. Okay, so I want to begin with a very revolutionary approach to the story, the culmination of Joseph, Judah, and the brothers. So let's just back up and give you a little context. So the Torah reading the last couple of weeks has revolved around the fracturing of the family of Jacob. Joseph is the favorite son, sold to slavery, speaking of Andrew Lloyd Webber, Technicolor Dreamcoats. If you've seen it or know about it, you kind of know the story. Joseph languishes in prison. He interprets Pharaoh's dreams, rises to become the viceroy of all of Mitzrayim at the land of Egypt. The brothers come down because the famine extends beyond the land of Egypt to the land of Canaan, the promised land. The brothers come down, sans Benjamin, who's left behind with Jacob back in the land of Canaan, for fear that the last remnant, if you will, of Rachel Imenu, of our mama Rachel, of Rachel, would not be given permission by Jacob to travel. It makes sense. Think about it for a moment. Where did Rachel die? On a journey home from Laban's house. When was Joseph last seen and thought to perhaps be dead? He was sent on a journey. So there's a very real and present danger in the mind of Jacob, of Yaakov, that if he sends the last part of Rachel on a journey, it's not going to have a happy ending. So he doesn't want to send Benjamin. The 10 brothers go down, and they are accused, of course, by Joseph, and they're put through this whole trial, and it has its ups and downs. And Joseph wants them to understand who he is. That's why we did a whole class called the Joseph Identity, like the Born Identity, where Joseph's throwing hints at them. Please, 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 figure out who I am. They never do. So the big reveal, Ani Yosef, just two words, I am Joseph. Ha'or Avichai, does my father still live? Those words occurred in the Parsha from this past week, by Yigash. Okay, so how does this denouement come? It's powerful stuff. So the brothers lunch with the king. And Joseph instructs his servant, his own son Menashe, we are told by the rabbis, to take his magic goblet, which of course has no magic at all, but because he knows the family, he did some tricks with it to show that he could identify people. He had inside information that nobody other than Joe, of course, would have. And he plants the goblet in whose sack? Benjamin. Kind of recreating Benjamin and Joseph's mother stealing those trapim, those idols, from old Laban when they left Laban's house unannounced. So he recreates that, hoping maybe the brothers will pick up on that recreation. And of course, they are oblivious. They don't pick up on it. So what happens? The brothers leave Egypt. And as soon as they leave, he tells Menashe, his son, to get the cavalry. They pursue after the brothers. They say, come on. my master is a formidable dream interpreter and necromancer. You think stealing his favorite goblet that you're going to get away with this? Now, of course, the brothers say, God forbid, we wouldn't steal from you. And if you find someone who is in possession of your master's goblet, that he should be like the death penalty and we'll all be slaves. They search everybody. Benjamin is the one who they find the gevi'ah because it's planted there. The brothers turn a little bit against Benjamin and kind of like say some not nice things to him, like, you know, huh, what's going on? You're just like Rachel who stole also. So they're brought back at the very end of Parshat Niketz. And it's like this incredible who shot JR style cliffhanger. Benjamin is there. The brothers fall. You couldn't even hear it. The words that they utter are literal words that we use when we beseech God on the Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement, to please forgive us. We've sinned, the one who stole the goblet, and all of us. And we're all ready, says Judah, to be slaves to you and to Pharaoh. And then what are the last words of the Parsha? And it ends with this finality, this great cliffhanger. Now Joseph says to them, God forbid, heaven forbid. I don't know if he said God forbid, because that might give it away. I don't think he said Baruch Hashem. So he says, far be it from me to do such a thing. Only the one who the goblet was in his sack, who yelli of it, he will be my slave, meaning Benjamin. And the rest of you, you're exonerated. Go back and have a nice life with your old dad back in the land of Canaan. Bye. And that's how it ends. And then, source one is the beginning of the new parsha from this past Shabbat. Then Judah approached him. Hebrew, Vayigosh Elav Yehuda. Judah approached him and said, please, my lord, lowercase l, let now your servant speak something into my lord's ears, and let not your wrath, your anger be kindled against your servant, for you are like Pharaoh. And then it goes on to tell, Judah has like 17 verses where he pours out a litany of the past and how they didn't really do anything wrong and they were accused, etc., etc. My question is, look at the first statement. Then Judah approached him and said, please, my lord. So who is he speaking to? So the common, what's called Pashup Shat, the simple explanation, which you will see in all the Chumashim and all the Bibles that you will read in English, is that he approaches Joseph. But there's a famous Torah commentator called the Abarbanel. And the Abarbanel doesn't like this. He said, yes, Judah's the king of the brothers. Unanointed at this point, because that doesn't happen until King David comes around many generations later. But he has within him the DNA of Malchut to be the king. So it's not crazy for Judah, the king of the brothers, to approach the king of the Egyptians. But Abarbanel doesn't like that. He doesn't think that a hedget, a commoner, if you will, would have the temerity to approach the king of Egypt, who's ostensibly the king of the civilized world. He doesn't buy that. And he has a whole different tract. So I heard this past Shabbat an amazing interpretation. And it hinges on a pronoun, of all things. And it will change your perception of everything here. You ready? And it fits the Abarbanels. So assume that Judah doesn't approach Joseph directly. He's speaking to him. In other words, when he says, please, my lord, let your servant speak something into my lord's ears, he's clearly addressing Joseph. The only question is, was he doing it from a distance or was it up close and personal? That's the question at hand. So listen to this. The last verse of the previous pasuk, of the previous verse, before we get to number one of Vayigash, it says, these are Joseph's words, the one whom, as again, we're talking pronouns, asher nimsaha gviya biyado, the one whom the goblet was found in his hands, hu yihye li avid, he will be to me a slave. Who is the he at that point? Benjamin! The pronoun, not once, but twice, is directly on Benjamin. So according to this Rabbi Shavi from the Gush Etzion in Israel, he says that the next line does not refer the pronoun him that he came close to does actually not refer to Joseph at all. It refers to Benjamin. Now, what does that mean? Whose life is in peril right now? Benjamin's life is in peril. Who promised his father, Jacob, that on his inheritance, both in this world and the next world, that he would take responsibility and protect Benjamin's life, even if it meant his own death? Judah. So whose life is in peril right now? Benjamin. What did the brothers do with poor Joseph when his life was in peril? Were they sensitive to it? Not at all. They left him alone and they sold him as a slave. Left him alone in a pit to cry, stripped him of his coat, right? And then eventually sell him, and he is alone. That's not happening here. You know what Judah does? Judah, vayigash elav Yehuda. Then Judah approached Benjamin. Stop. So he walks over to his brother, Benjamin, who is shaking and crying, and he puts his arm around him, and he stands next to Benjamin. And then and only then does he direct his words threatening the life of the Egyptian ruler. He stands with Benjamin. What a difference. In other words, when someone is in danger, when someone is in pain or suffering, what is the single greatest act that we can do to show them that they are not alone? We stand with them. That's what we have been doing since October the 7th. We have been standing with our brothers and sisters. Benjamin is in peril in Israel. And we walk over and we hug them. And we let them know, you are not alone. We stand with you. And so many who are not Jewish, millions around the world, have been standing at the side of Benjamin when he's in peril. So I just thought, wow, it gave me goosebumps, you know, when I first saw this, because I thought, wow, how appropriate that this explanation fits where we are now and what we can do as Jews, as members of the B'nai Israel. We can emulate Judah's sensitivity to little brother Benjamin. So let's carry on. So finally, the brothers are reunited. Joseph is forced, and according to this explanation, by the way, this was the moment that brought Joseph's identity from Joseph. In other words, when he saw the care and love that Judah had for his little brother Benjamin, lo yisapek, he could not withhold his identity any longer. It was that care that Judah displayed in front of Joseph that brought Joseph out to say, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? So the two are related. So after the big reveal, the brothers are discombobulated. They can't respond to Joseph. So he comes to them, he hugs them, he cries for the loss. But they don't really respond because they're just too shaken. Now, Benjamin had no grievance with Joseph. He was not, of course, involved in the sale of Joseph. There was no enmity or jealousy between... He was a little boy, right? He was like 8 years old when Joseph was sold. He was a little boy. Now he's 30. So the two brothers cry. So listen to this. It's number two. Again, pronouns. And he, Joseph, fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept on his neck. So simple explanation, you can't get back the 22 years of separation. Joseph didn't get to see his little baby brother Benjamin grow up and become a man. Each of Benjamin's 10 sons were named in honor of Benjamin's lost brother Joseph. So there's an incredible connection between the two siblings. Okay, but it gets better than that. They're crying not only for the moment, but they're crying for the future, according to Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. And Joseph fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. This is number three. Why did he weep? For the two temples, which were destined to be in Benjamin's territory and would ultimately be destroyed, first by the Babylonians, Nebuchadnezzar, and the second one in the year 70 by the Romans. Benjamin wept on Joseph's neck. Why? For the tabernacle of Shiloh, which was destined to be in Joseph's territory, yet would ultimately be destroyed. So what's going on here? At the height of their simcha, of their jubilation and joy, reunification of the family, you talk about a sour moment? So you can't even enjoy the fact, Joseph, that Benjamin's here, and Benjamin, you can't even, you're already looking like hundreds of years down the turnpike for this horrible moment where the temples will be destroyed and what's going on? Why is it here? In other words, clearly, it's not a conscious thing. They're not prophets to the point where there's something going on that can, how do you understand this, Rashi? That's what I'm trying to say. In other words, in the moment, Joseph and Benjamin are not getting a prophecy from God. I really don't believe they are, that this is going to happen. So then what does this mean? What is Rashi trying to convey? So here is the sad part of the equation. Not everything was healthy yet in the family of Israel. It wasn't healthy yet. And so they, Benjamin and Joseph, Joseph and Benjamin, on some level of their subconscious, were already sensitive to the fact that there was a rapprochement, yes, but it wasn't a complete rapprochement. And that the fracturing of the family that happened with the sale of Joseph, and ostensibly was somewhat healed now, there would still lurk dark elements within the 12 tribes of Israel that would cause the dissolution of Israel, culminating in what? The loss of our temples, the holy places where we worship God. Why were they destroyed? Sinat chinam. Because of baseless hatred, one Jew to another Jew. So that is what Rashi is trying to give voice to. In other words, I don't think it was a specific thing. He's telling us, oh, by the way, the fact that they're worried and crying for something later makes sense because it's their own land. The temples were located, at least the Mizbeach, the altar from God was located on the territory of Benjamin. Benjamin and Judah's territory literally meet right by the Har HaBayit, by the Holy Temple Mount in Jerusalem. They're literally next door to each other. So Benjamin's territory included the altar, the Mizbeach. Joseph's territory included Shiloh, where the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was the precursor to the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. So in other words, they're not specifically thinking of these things, but they're sensitive to all is not well amongst the Jewish people. So that's kind of a sad thing. But it also teaches us a very sobering lesson. In the same way that Judah stands with Benjamin, we, unfortunately, as the Jewish people, can sometimes be our own worst enemies, that we bring the wrath and destruction upon ourselves through our own disunity, our own lack of harmony, and just common decency in Derech Eretz, one to another. I mean, again, God forbid, there's no condemnation of anything, but you can't lose sight of the fact of the horror of the fracture that was going on in Israeli society prior to October the 7th. I mean, that is like right there. Every one of you must have thought about that. So again, we are not condemning because I'm not smart enough and I'm not pious enough. That's not what we're doing. We're just showing that there was a fracture, right, the judicial reform, and beyond that, there were other things going on where Jew was against Jew. That is an unholy thing that eventually leads in one place only, destruction for the Jewish people. There's just no way around it, right? When we live in harmony, we have, and it's not that we as Jews have to agree, right? Because it's like the old joke, right? Two Jews and 25 opinions, okay? That's normal to have different opinions. But when there's a lack of honor and respect and just basic derech eretz, just common decency, how you treat somebody and value somebody. I can hate your politics and love you as a human being. The two don't have any connection to reality, right? I don't care about certain things, right? You could be an Eagles fan and I could be a Giants fan, I think. And we can still love each other because it's just a game, right? We understand, we think, right? Moshe's like, I'm not sure about that. But in normal cases, you know, it doesn't matter to me. You're voting for the North Carolina Tar Heels and I'm voting for the Wolf Pack. That's a pretty bad rivalry there. So it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, we love each other because we have so much that we share in common. So again, this sort of also echoes so much about what's happening today, doesn't it? Right here in the Parsha. Okay, let's carry on, please. So number five. So they, the brothers, I love the pronouns, went up from Egypt, and they came to the land of Canaan, Israel, to their father Jacob. And they told Jacob, saying, Ha'od Yosef Chai. Wow, what great words. Joseph is still alive. And they told Jacob that he ruled. He, Joseph, ruled over the entire land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart changed. I'm just filling in the names instead of the pronouns. For Jacob did not believe them. And the brothers told Jacob, I love the pronouns. It's great, right? I've got, have fun with this one. And the brothers told Jacob all of Joseph's words that Joseph had said to them. And Jacob saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, and the spirit of their father Jacob was revived. Utechi ruach Yaakov. This was the moment that Jacob came back to life. So what happened? So you need a little context. So when Joseph is sold, what do the brothers bring to Jacob? They bring the torn up technicolor dream coat, covered in the blood of a goat, which apparently closely represents human blood. Again, I don't know if that's true. I haven't seen a slaughtered goat, but I'll take that as a truth. And they said, Hakerna, do you recognize this, dear old dad, Yaakov? Right? Hazeb bincha, hazeb sonis bincha hin lo. Is this your dear son Joseph's technicolor dream coat or not? And it says he recognized it, and he said, "Aye, a wild animal has torn my son Joseph asunder." So it's a famous, famous moment, right? The brothers never understood the deep connection that Jacob had with Joseph. This was Rachel for Joseph, and Rachel was dead. So that connection was undervalued by the brothers. So no matter how much they tried to comfort him, it says they all got up, all of his children, to comfort Jacob, no success. It says, Vayima'ein lehistachem. He refused to be comforted. So the rabbis say you can't really be comforted for someone who's thought to be dead but really alive, because God doesn't help us to get over that person. That's why the horror of having hostages or having, you know, someone whose life is unknown, someone who is an MIA, it's the most horrific death sentence for a parent, because you can't bury the person because you don't even know if they're alive or dead. It's unimaginable, the horror that our people have been put through by design. It's just horrible. Okay, so what happens for 22 years? God's Ruach HaKodesh, God's spirit, if you will, that would sort of be in the blood and life force of Jacob, departed Jacob. So for 22 years, he doesn't have that intimate connection to Hashem, to God, that he used to have. It comes back at that moment. He is rejuvenated. He's reborn. So that's what it says. It says, Utechi Ruach Yaakov, his spirit, came back to life. Yeah? So it's powerful. But what was the moment that he saw the spirit come back to Jacob? Very weird. Listen to the words. I don't know if you caught this. So they're telling him everything, but when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent, then he comes back to life. The wagons? What's the correlation between the wagons that Joseph sent and Jacob coming back to be a human being again and God coming? What? The wagons? Yeah. So, number six, this is Rashi. Joseph gave them a sign. He said to his brothers, I don't think Yaakov, our father, is going to believe you. But I'm going to give you some inside information that he and I alone are privy to. And if you will share this information with our father, he will undoubtedly believe you. Because there's only two people in the world, other than God, who could know this information. Myself and Dad. So you'll tell him. So here's the information. What was the topic that Joseph was engaged in when Joseph was separated from Jacob? They were going to Shechem, they were walking, and they were talking Torah, because Jacob and Joseph were talking Torah. They're having a little Torah class. Jacob was teaching Joseph some rules of the Torah. That was the section dealing with the heifer, the cow, that was not beheaded, it's the wrong term, but its neck is broken. And this is what the Torah says. He, Jacob, saw the wagons Joseph had sent. And the Torah does not say that Pharaoh had sent. Okay, so we need to understand this. Who sent the wagons to bring back Jacob, who was old, and all the possessions of the brothers and all their family? Pharaoh had made that edict. It wasn't Joseph. Pharaoh told Joseph, take the wagons, go back home, bring your family to me, and I'll take care of them personally here because of the famine in the land of Canaan. But yet, the pasuk, the verse says, literally, Joseph had sent them. The wagons that Joseph had sent, but it wasn't Joseph. They were Pharaoh's wagons. Why the change? Because Joseph had sent, this is the hint, Joseph had sent the wagons as a hint to dear old dad. So the brother said, by the way, dad, Joseph told us that you won't believe us. He told us to tell you that the last Torah you were learning when you were away from the house, when you bid him farewell for the last time 22 years ago, you were learning about the law where there are two cities or two towns and they find a murder victim in between the two towns. So they would measure the proximity of the murder victim to the closest town. And then the elders and rabbis of that town would come out and they would basically take this sin offering, this calf, and they would basically take responsibility over that poor person. They would say, well, God forbid, we did not host this poor man who was murdered by bandits on the highway. It wasn't our fault. We didn't offer him hospitality and a place to stay, and he was predated upon by some vicious people. So they would do an atonement. So that's the whole concept here. So somehow, that is alluded to in the word wagon. You know how it's alluded to? Because the word for a wagon is ayin gimel lamed hey. I left it in the Hebrew there in the middle of number 6. You see, it says egla arufa. It's on the third line in parentheses after the first three English words. So that first word, egla, means both an egel, a calf, meaning the animal that was killed to do atonement. But the word agala, if you take out those three letters and insert different actual vowels, it also could spell the word for a wagon. So a wagon and a cow, same word in Hebrew, if you play with not the letters, but play with the vowels, okay? So that is the hint. Does everyone understand so far? So the wagons is an allusion to the cow discussion that Jacob had with Joseph. Oh, but there's so much more. It wasn't just that the brothers imparted to Jacob the news that Joseph is living. And proof is, we have this inside little information that you guys were studying the law of the goal, of the calf, of the eagle. Remember the eagle hazahav, just to give you some context. Eagle hazahav means golden calf. The word eagle means a calf. So agala also means a wagon. That's much more than that. You see, in the distance, many years after Jacob's death, his great-grandchildren would build a magnificent home for God. It was called the Mishkan, the tabernacle. That was the same tabernacle that was on Joseph's territory in Shiloh that was destroyed by the Philistines. Now, the inauguration of God's home was an amazing event. There were 12 tribes. Levites were excluded, so therefore Joseph's family was divided into two parts. Joseph had two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, and they were given certain rights as tribal princes. So there were 12 offerings. So when you go in Parshat Naso, it's the longest Torah reading of the year, they repeat word for word the 12 gifts that the tribal princes brought for the 12 days preceding the inauguration of God's home, the tabernacle. But what's stunning is that each gift is literally identical. So the first day, Nachshon ben Aminadab, the tribal prince of Judah, he brings these gifts. And there's like about 5 verses. And then the next day, day 2, the next prince brings a gift. And these princes were very well-to-do, to say the least. And they could have brought anything they wanted to. But they didn't want one to outdo the other. So they brought the same to show cohesion and a lack of competition between the brothers. When Jacob saw the wagons, what had just happened at that moment for the first time in 22 years? God's spirit came back. He had, on some level, a vision of the future and of those 12 tribal princes, each bringing those magnificent gifts and not being enemies, the 12 tribes, but being, instead of adversarial, working together to not embarrass one to another. But it's better than that. What did they bring the magnificent gifts on? Wagons. How many wagons did they bring? 12, right? No, they only brought 6. So the rabbis go crazy. They say, now wait a minute. These guys are the wealthiest guys to be, right? There's Zuckerberg and there's Rothschild and there's, you know, Bronfman. They can afford a wagon to bring their gifts. So why are they wagon pooling? So each day they shared, each tribe, one wagon for 2 tribes. It was that Jacob saw somehow in his heart. The cohesion, the lack of enmity and jealousy, the fact that the Jewish tribes could work together as a unit, that we would be one nation under God, so to speak. That was what brought the full life of Jacob back, because he understood the enormity of what had happened to Joseph and the sale, almost murder of Joseph. And now to be encouraged that there's a future moment when God's home is inaugurated and the Jews are all working together. Shevet Achim Gam Yachad. One Jew working with the next as one. And this is where Israel wins the day. When we can be working together, wagon pooling together, sharing resources together, a brother standing with another brother in need. These are the moments that, in the same way, if you will, that Joseph and Benjamin tap into this future destruction of the temples, Jacob is tapping in, because he's father Israel, to this magnificent moment of the inauguration where Jewish people will be working together. And he knows that if we will work together like this, the world will be a different place. All right, so let me leave you with something even better. Okay? So if you will, this is not from the Bible. Are you ready? But this is really good. Alexander the Great, and let me preface this. You probably know, you may even have children who are named Alex or Alexander. It's not a Jewish name. But in honor of Alexander's benevolence and piety towards the Jewish people, and there's a great stories about Shimon HaTzadik, of Simon the Righteous, how he met with Alexander, and the young version of Alexander was coming to basically conquer Israel, left Israel alone with dictates not to harm the Jews and allow them to practice their religion. Okay, now I know it didn't end well with the Greeks later on, but that wasn't Alexander of Macedonia, okay? In honor of Alexander's benevolence towards the Jews, Jewish moms and dads for generations would name their children Alex, Alexander, Alexa, Alexandra. So any name you have in your family as a Jew who happens to have that Alex, you know where it comes from, okay? So Alexander, the king of Macedonia and ruler of most of the civilized world, died at a young age. I got this from somewhere online, probably not Wikipedia. Before he embarked on his conquest of Asia, Alexander inquired into the welfare and stability of his loyal followers, lest their dependents fall destitute during the long battle. He was worried, what's going back on the home front of my loyal compatriots who are helping me in conquer the world? After assessing their needs, the needs of his followers, Alexander dispersed nearly all his royal resources amongst his faithful. His friend General Perdiccas was surprised. What have you reserved for yourself? He asked Alexander. Hope, answered the king. There is always hope. In that case, replied his followers, we who share in your labor shall share in your hope. With that, they refused the wealth that Alexander allotted. Now that, I mean, that's like an amazing story, right? I mean, that cuts right, it's not Jewish, but it cuts right to your soul. This is where we are left off at the end of this week's Parsha. So last week we had the denouement, Judah coming close, Vayigash, the reveal. This week in Vayechi, we end with a very difficult ending. Joseph, we are told, dies. All the brothers die. They didn't die in a bad way. They died of old age. Joseph died the first. He was the first to go, the youngest of the tribes. They all died and they were in Egypt. And we know in the book of Exodus that Yul Brynner and the boys are not benevolent towards the Jewish people. So we know what's coming down the road. Okay? It's going to be really bad. What happens to Joseph? So let me walk you through number 7. And Joseph said to his brothers, I die. But God will surely remember you and bring you up out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel. He made them swear, saying, Pakod yivkod elokim eschem, God will surely remember you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. Meaning, I, Joseph, will not be buried in the land of Israel like our father and like mom, grandparents, great-grandparents, Abraham and Sarah and Isaac. They're all buried in Israel. I'm not going to Israel right now. He had the power, Joseph. I'm staying here. My remains will be here until the redemption happens, until the hope that we have will be realized. I'm here for the long term. And we are told that when the Jewish people exited the land of Egypt, all the tribal remains were taken out. Each tribe had a coffin with the preserved remains. Remember, Egyptians used to embalm the dead, so it wasn't so crazy. They would take out the remains of each of the tribal leaders, the originators. In other words, Judah went with the tribe of Judah, etc. They took them through the desert, and they buried them ultimately in the land of Israel. So what happens to Joseph's remains? It's very, very vivid imagery. He, Joseph, remember, what did Joseph never get to do again? Never went home. Think about that. He sent the brothers to bring Jacob to him. Joseph never, ever got to go home, did he? Not in this world. In the next world. And he says, I'm not ready to go home yet. I will go home when God keeps his promise to the Jewish people and we get Israel. So they take his body and they embalm it, mummify it, or whatever they did to it, and they put it in a casket, in a bier, in an aron, steel lead casket, and they drop it into the Nile River. They did it because Joseph told the brothers, you can't leave unless I leave with you. So the worry was maybe the Jews would become so successful that they would leave. But if they didn't know where Joseph's remains were, they can't leave without fulfilling their promise to him. So they took his body, they put it in a coffin, and they dumped it into the Nile River. He goes into the water of the Nile River, and that's how it ends, with a finality that we're covered with water. There's a darkness that poor Joseph is sort of in limbo, waiting for what's going to happen in Exodus and the ultimate redemption. He's waiting there under the water. But then think of the magnificence of this. What words did Joseph adjure the Jewish people to remember? I'll repeat them. They're in number 7. God will surely remember you and bring you up out of this land. That's a promise. Pakod yivkod. From that water, that same literal water of the Nile, who gets plucked out of the water? Joseph's put into the water, and then the next parsha, who gets taken out of that water? Moses! Moses comes out of the same depths of the water where Joseph's remains were confined. How did Moses, get recognized as Moses? Do you want to take a guess what phrase made the people believe? No one believed him because there were a lot of messianic characters apparently walking around saying, yeah, God spoke to me last night and I'm here to take y'all out. And they all said, nah, you're not the guy. So when Moses came forth, again, they were like, they're a little cynical. No, you're not the guy. And then word spread because Moses had been told at the bush, there was a very specific dialogue that he has to use. God has surely remembered you. So they go to this old woman named Sarah, who's the only person remaining. She's very ancient, and she remembers the promise that Joseph made at the end of number 7, that God will remember you. So she said, I don't think he's not the guy. He's not the Redeemer. He's not the Mashiach. He's not the guy. But then they said, but he said, God has remembered you and will take you up. Boom, she got up, the old lady, Sarah, and said, he's the guy. If that's what he said to you, that is the phrase that I've carried with me all my life. He's the man. So the hope that Joseph instilled into the Jewish people, even in the darkness, being submerged for hundreds of years under the waters of the Nile, that hope materializes in Moshe, in Moses, the first Mashiach, the first redeemer of the Jewish people. And we now hope, of course, for that Geula. We are in a darkness. We feel we are submerged. We don't know exactly what's going to be for the future of the Jewish people of Israel. But I promise you, in the same way that Bakot Yivko, that Joseph made the Jewish people promise, we have to hold next to our hearts that haftacha, that belief, that strident faith in God, that emunah, that God will redeem us, that from the depths, the Jewish people will rise again.